You are listening to a Triple Canopy podcast. To hear more, visit www.canopycanopycanopy.com.
I grew up, insofar as I have grown up, with the idea that the text is the thing, and beware of the writer talking about his or her own work, because it's usually lies, although maybe it isn't. And sometimes if you're talking about your book, it may be because ultimately you feel that the book doesn't work by itself, and so you've got to explain it. And or more often, people ask you about the book, whether or not they read it. And one can feel a bit eerie and odd and uncomfortable explaining the book that they haven't read, when in fact the book should be its own explanation. So writers talking has a downside, I think. But
You just pointed out that I'm about 50 years younger than you, almost, and so I'm from the generation where what you do is you...
You were born in 1980.
1980, yes. And you
what day?
September 6th.
September 6th.
Yes. Virgo.
Virgo, yeah. Virgo, yeah. The day after my father's birthday. Mm-hmm. And I was born in 1930, mm-hmm. August 21st.
Wow. That's also Virgo, is it not?
No, it's still Leo.
Still Leo.
If you believe in that stuff.
I don't.
But being the kind of novelist you are, you can both believe in that stuff and not believe in that stuff.
I can pay lip service. What I was saying is I'm from the generation where you're supposed to talk about your book before you even write it. You know, whereas I think...
Are you talking about your generation?
My generation, yes.
I guess that's true.
Yeah. So I feel that in that way we're kind of opposites.
Though I think when I was at the various stages when I was trying to grow up, I heard people talking about work that they hadn't done. And I think I was very, very resistant to that. I remember when I was at Columbia, there was a guy I used to run into at Bickford's when there was a Bickford's there at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he would say, "I'm writing a play," and you knew that play probably wasn't ever going to happen. And then there was a guy in Carpenter Library, which is the English, is it still the English Literature Library at Columbia?
It's been absorbed.
Oh, it's been absorbed. Okay. And he was writing a novel there for 10, 15 years. And so there certainly is a tradition of, on the one hand, talking about stuff in order not ever to do it, and also talking in order to cheer yourself up. But I know that we were talking about families before, and mine was not especially supportive. But it doesn't mean your family doesn't love you. It just means they can't really relate to your being an artist, and they take the conservative view that you'll never be able to have a life, which is an interesting phrase.
Fortunately, Josh's family is from Atlantic City, so they had the benefit of being able to send him into the casinos to be an artist.
Right.
Exactly.
So
that is true.
Oh, well, he's...
certain locales, you don't have to deal with that problem.
He has a... from what I've heard him say just recently, certainly a decisive view of how he wants to run his life, at least at your age of 29 or 30, whatever you are now.
I wanted to begin, because we had been talking before this talk about realism,
yeah.
and about what is called realism. And I've been, thanks to Sam, I've been reading an entire bag of your books, over the past few weeks.
Poor guy.
And no. And
you're reading them at the same time?
No. But I feel actually, I'm reading Lookout Cartridge while I am traveling between cities, so I feel that's probably appropriate.
Good, sure.
And if you wouldn't mind, I wanted to begin a conversation by reading a paragraph from Lookout Cartridge. Would that be okay?
Flattered.
This book, you can film it, was it 1970? Should I look it up?
1974, I think.
74.
Yeah.
And in this book, toward the beginning of it, is this beautiful paragraph and a half that is almost a Kafka parable buried in a realist text. And because of the context, which is to say it's the narrative flow and the opening of a book, you kind of pass over it. But I want to read it before I say anything else about it. And it's the drive-in movie screen. Or the landslip drive-in movie. whose monumental screen under clean and clement American stars, and in front of you and 100 other cars without audible warning, one summer night began to lower, to tilt back hugely and drop as if into a slot in the earth. The image became yours, even more surely by disappearing. It disappeared with a distinguished rumble mixed with what still came out of the speaker draped over the edge of your car window. An actress and actor in the corrected colors of the spectrum had been touching each other's colossal faces, and their breaths kept coming faster and more intimately loud to bring right into your car this whopping slide of mouths and fingers and nostrils inserted into the night pines and sea sky above the locally well-known clay cliffs that had just enjoyed their first clear day in 2 weeks. But now, for the first time since before World War II, a section of cliff gives way, and the famous faces are swept as if by their camera right up off the monumental screen until you have only the upper half of the two torsos thrown onto the remaining upper half of the descending screen as it tilts back toward the sea. And now, where's the movie? The drive-in screen's rear props fall with the clay cliff, and mouths and cheekbones and eyelids have tipped away under the projector's light. Then you have before you ocean sky, not to mention an experience tomorrow's news won't do justice to. And you get your feet on the ground as your speaker with its static swings with the car door. You look to the rear of the drive-in and see many silhouettes doing the same as you. You find the cone of light still projected. Circuits in the head make the image feasible. These often bypass other printed circuits, neater and newer. These newer circuits can ask questions not so sharp as the images streaming from older circuits, but still of interest to me. Questions like, is there an insurance group prepared to write a policy to cover landslip drive-in up to and including landslip itself? Would fissures appear well in advance of such a major landslip? What are the dimensions of such a cinema screen? How many outdoor drive-in screens, 100 by 60 feet, exist in England? So, the way that I read this, or that I read it outside of the context and the function of the book, is it's just an amazing parable to me of realism that could just be read in many different ways. You have this image projected at a screen. The screen falls.
Which is already a simulacrum of the real.
Which, exactly. And
two-dimensional in a way.
And it's also a replacement for the sky directly behind it. It's the curtain for the sky. And then the cliffs give way. This enormous drive-in screen falls. And yet the cone of light, which is, on one hand, could be, you know, our perception of reality coming at the screen. It just goes and goes, and as we know, you know, these waves go forever. These waves never end. I was just reading an article that right now they found out what star Orson Welles' War of the Worlds went past the other day. So, you know, these things go infinitely, and so I just thought this was just a very rich parable, and I was wondering, did you intend it to be a parable? Do you remember?
I remembered it. Yeah, I thought, that's pretty good. thank you for, yeah. You know, one is afraid to look at old work. One is. I am. I think most writers resist it. I think painters feel the same thing about having a show of old work, you know. Not that the new work, well, anyhow. No, I thought that was interesting. If I speak of intention, which is maybe I'm risking simply being inaccurate to the time. I think I was aware of three or four things when I was writing. I was aware, first of all, of writing a passage that would be a little bit like that screen, and that would slide into the narrative as it already is functioning. And the part of the form of Lookout Cartridge is to make quick cuts from one scene to another and from one kind of subject matter to another. And there's nothing unusual about that, except that in 1974, that use of cinema and audio as well wasn't too common in American fiction, any more than the kind of use of science that I've made in one or two of my books was common. But I think the idea of sliding one image almost awkwardly in front of another image to interrupt the view and yet perhaps to make a juxtaposition which would be like metaphor. You'd have two things which are cutting each other off or side by side, and suddenly you think they're like each other. It's a little bit different in a passage in Wits, where you compare Xmas, Christmas I almost said, but it's Xmas,
sure,
to a visitor who stays too long and is not particularly wanted.
Mm-hmm.
It at first it's comfortable and familiar, but having established the metaphor, you then take the right-hand side of the metaphor and develop it and develop it and develop it. But the reader has the Xmas in mind all the time. And it's as if you've put two things which are unalike, mm-hmm, together, develop one, and before you know it, the first thing you were thinking about is made to disappear. Now, that book, Lookout Cartridge, is, the very word cartridge might suggest slipping a unit of some sort into a larger machine or device. And that's partly what this is about. And it's about explosions that come from that. And it's even about the main character thinking ultimately that he himself is like a cartridge inserted into a reality that he does not fully understand. I think I pulled that off pretty well. But there is from the beginning, with the central plot of a missing film, a sense not only that this is about a film and audio that goes with it, but it is also about seeing. And you can't find the film in order to see what is on the film. And so at once there's a puzzle, a disturbing, overlapping, multiplying puzzle of the real.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's assumed that one real, in fact, in the Village Voice there was a review published in which they spelled it R-E-E-L, but the real, yeah, is an epistemological question in that book, but the real also is associated with now you see it, now you don't,
sure,
and also with ultimately the importance of the words. The words are there, and that's in a way all the reader has got, and so the words become a surface that is real, but of course it's much more than a surface. It's a medium by means of which to understand.
I wanted to also, in talking about your relationship to the real, read two sentences, actually, that I thought were really phenomenal from a statement called Midcourse Corrections, which appeared in the Review of Contemporary Fiction in spring of 1990. And this is sort of they asked you for a piece of fiction and or a statement of aesthetic purpose or something, and what you gave them is sort of a self-fictionalization with a few interviews with people.
They wanted an interview.
They wanted an interview.
I take off on that,
no,
for a moment. They wanted an interview,
okay,
because the issue was had some essays about me, and they wanted me to supply something. And so instead of an interview, and there was someone who wanted to do an interview with me. In fact, it was the end of a friendship when I decided not to do that. I decided I would go and interview three people who had been important in my life. And that turned out very well. One of them, I interviewed because I discovered she was still alive, which was a surprise.
This was your teacher, Edna Conrad.
Edna Conrad was over here at Brooklyn Friends, which is where it was then.
Did you say that he grew up
she
in
was in
Brooklyn
Vermont.
Heights?
Yeah, and she was in Vermont living at age 96 or something. But so I thought... I can tell that he's a bit cantankerous and contrary, and you have to be, I think, to be a writer. And I thought, no, I don't want some interview, you know. And so I was doing the interviewing, taking charge, and picking the people that I wanted to interview.
Well, to be further cantankerous, the interviews do comprise about half of the piece.
Right.
Because the rest of it is a sort of a self-inquiry and a a statement. I mean, you're a statement at avoiding statements. Let's
that was
say.
Another thing that I wanted to change, yeah. if I could. I mean, just as I thought, this was not new to you at all, I know, mm-hmm. but when we were going to read together, I thought, well, let's have a conversation mm-hmm. and then dip into the readings rather than, you know, he reads and then I read. Or, I mean, I think this is a little bit more interesting.
I hope so.
Yeah.
But I wanted to read
it's heterogeneous in a way and unpredictable.
Trying. But in my hopeful practice, meaning his hopeful practice, a figure in a working conversation between outside documentable detail and an inside greedy rhetoric of impulse, still more, an inertial field extending a function of the enclosed perceiving subject outward to describe and establish where I am not, and where the precincts of the controlling author might be given up. And then 2 pages later, you have the city, because a significant portion of your work has concerned the city, maybe not just New York City, but also the idea of the city and the function of the city. Mm. The city, which can be made to equal the possibility of talk, is us, or almost us in our potential absence from it. The city, which can be made to equal the possibility of talk, is us, or almost us in our potential absence from it. And I was thinking about this a lot.
Thank you for reading it again. I would not dismiss that at all. I think it's great, and I'm glad you picked it out. But I think it out Faulkner. Faulkner's when Faulkner was taxed with the difficulty of his prose, and he said, "If it is not understood the first time, it may be read again."
Sure.
And it's kind of you to read that again.
It's always helpful to read.
I wanted to say somewhere here, and apropos of large books, because you have here a large book, and I think there are certain presuppositions that go with that, that you have many languages, and I think of myself as having many languages also, and I think that it's all very well to have a wonderfully concrete phantasmagoria of contemporary life in your vocabulary and your perception, which you do. But remembering that language is not just something to flow over you and to be excited by and say, oh, the language, you got to know, you got to see, you got to, just the language. But language is also pointing to things. And I think maybe literature is not made out of words but out of sentences. I think that makes more sense to me. And if so, then the sentences that are made out of the words, made out of the language, are pointing to certain things. And there are declarative sentences, there are long sentences, short sentences. And in the end, I believe that the writers I have admired, and you are a new one, are philosophers. Not in the sense that the word philosophy is often used pejoratively, as having something to do with ideas in the abstract. Rather, what Wittgenstein, I think, meant when he said somewhere that philosophy is the need of questioning, and just as Melville is a philosopher, and you see toward the end of Bartleby the Scrivener, this man who's not used to thinking very deeply about his life, going back and forth and weaving back and forth with these short sentences, questioning himself, what on earth is going on here in this increasingly intimate and puzzling relation I have with this creep? And it's basically thinking. And I believe that the passage you read there is me thinking and even thinking about thought at the same time that I hope it's physical and concrete, existential or something.
I mean, the reason why I kind of singled that passage out, it's the idea of the city being us and the city being our talking. And that, to me, is a much more interesting description of realism than what could be considered the conventionalities of realism, which is to say, to represent not the world as it is, but to represent the world as we would like it not to be, but the world as we would like it to be packaged. The world as we would like it to be framed, you know?
And as it is officially received.
And as officially received, exactly. Yeah. I mean, you know, realism is much more of a consensus activity than reality.
Yeah.
Reality is far more atomized, is far more discrete in terms of, you know, the length of our perceptions, the length of our memories, the length of our ability our ability to process information. Whereas, you know, realism is much more of this this accepted notion of packaging. And it's interesting to me that realism became the word in literature, whereas, you know, in painting, for example, you have these very interesting differences between schools of realist painting. You have precisionism, you know, which was a certain thing. You have
in the 60s there was something called new realism.
Exactly. But still,
which was almost photographic, but not.
And in literature, I really feel like you have this kind of classic realism, and which we see from the 19th century. And then we have, you know, obviously going into the 20th century, we have this kind of fetish of the real in the Nouveau Roman. And in your work, I see that you kind of discard both of those ideas in favor of this reality of recording the mind experiencing the real. And that's done probably most interestingly in something like Plus, in which you have a brain circling the world.
You could just say, in which I have a brain.
In which you have a brain, sure.
Yeah.
And the brain is this monumental filter of the real. And I wanted to kind of talk about reality versus realism, and with the jumping off point being that the city is us and that talk is us, and asking you how you see the approach to documenting what you see in front of you. Is it faithfulness to the event as you see it? Is it faithfulness to an ideal of an event? Is it because you're making a rhetorical argument underneath things?
It's probably all of those things, but well, I side with Proust rather than Hemingway. I mean, I learned all the lessons that I was supposed to learn from Hemingway, and it's partly leaving out. And he says you make it up out of what you know, and he doesn't really do that, but you make it up out of what you know. He doesn't make it up enough, or he doesn't include enough, in my view. And what is left out in Hemingway's realism leaves a result which is very beautiful. It's very aesthetic, in a way. It's arty, in fact, I think, because he leaves out so much. And his view, to give him credit, was that having left out so much, you make it possible for the reader to, in a way, experience what has been left out, that if somehow it's evoked, what has been left out is still evoked. But then I go to Proust, or I go to almost any writer I can think of offhand, and I feel that so much is left out in Hemingway that it isn't exactly real. It's at best, it's often a dramatization of severe tests that men are placed under, and that's interesting. You know, Cormac McCarthy carries that on a little bit. But it leaves out so much that Hemingway's, I ultimately came to feel, is unreal. And Proust, who puts in so much and too much in a way, has nonetheless a superb mind. And the real that we are given in even those 60, 70-page passages about one thing that someone said at a tea party is not only it's the multiplying real in Proust's mind, but it's the possibility of the multiplying real that lies around us all the time, which makes life so interesting. I realized a long time ago that happiness is not exactly the thing, but it's interestingness that you want to maintain, which isn't necessarily happiness. But different kinds of real, recording the real certainly is part of what I think a writer should be able to do. Mm-hmm. And if you speak of, but to convey the perceiver inside is another thing which has to be done, I think.
You know, and maybe this can segue into...
I would like to speak of plot. Go ahead, what you're saying.
I'm saying that, you know, maybe this can lead to a discussion of the large book, but in the largest of your books, which is about men and women, and men as women and women as men, maybe, and you have this very interesting distinction, and someone coins the phrase, the colloidal unconscious.
Oh, yeah.
And he points
out... Don't quiz me on that, please.
No, I won't, but it's very interesting that something is pointed out that there's a solution. This is, you know, and there's a suspension, and then there's a colloid, and a colloid is when the harder particles that haven't become completely dissolved in the liquid kind of float, you know, like when you rub your eyes and you can see the rods and cones kind of floating around. It's this idea of these floating particles of the real that you mentioned in this conversation. I think it's around page 700 in this book. But it's
showing off.
But it's a fascinating idea of this colloidal consciousness, because it seems to me that not only is that the subject of a lot of your books, but it's also the method by which they've been written, and it's the unification, I think, of the fractured nature of the conversations that your characters have, and also the fractured way in which it's told, that I think makes them great.
Well, when you say it's not only a subject that's referred to, and of course it's an invented concept in the book, but as I think you must have picked up, and I think a lot of sympathetic readers did pick up, I'm not just kidding about the colloidal unconscious. Maybe I'm being a mad scientist, but I'm not kidding about it. It is the way the book is written. Mm-hmm. So that's one other thing that it is. But I'm at the edge here of a habit of mind and a quest, which I would associate with the word homology, in which what is often thought of as metaphor might be taken quite literally. So that, I was thinking about it the other day. I've been working on a book about water for 5 years, and now it's coming to an end, I hope. And it's a
nonfiction book about water.
It's a nonfiction book about water, yeah. And I was thinking again about colloids and solvents, and it's ultimately a book about our take on water. It is, and what that means. And I'm hoping that doesn't move not only into the aesthetics of water, and there's a lot of art and literature in my book, but also hangs on to all of the ethical questions that are involved with the water emergencies globally. So I'm trying to do an awful lot. But in the course of that, I got thinking again about colloids and particles floating around. And went back and thought about Brownian motion, which I'm sure some of you know about, which arises from a Scottish biologist of the 19th century who noticed particles that were being affected by molecules and heat, and that the patterns that could be found there were not only plottable, but they were also to some extent random. And Einstein made something of this later on, and it was partly through the Brownian motion theme that I got thinking about colloidal solutions when I was writing that book. And this is a pitch, I have to say, because Jen Hyde is here, and she's bringing out a chapbook of a story of mine that was published in 1984, but it's a book now, which is exactly what it ought to be. And the characters who were in this partly Lower Manhattan series of incidents in the early 80s, I guess, late 70s, early 80s, move around in relationships that are a little bit like, well, I thought there was a colloidal unconscious here, but it's mainly a kind of Brownian motion. And I'm thinking, and I thought again when I reflected on this and suggested to her that it might be an interesting emblem for the book, which she's getting started now, it's coming out in the end of June, we hope. I got thinking that Brownian motion in us is just as real when we think of it as a metaphor for mobile relations among people as it is when you analyze it chemically. Now, that's hard to demonstrate. but it's as far as I go. I'm a lapsed Presbyterian, and it's about as far as I go toward anything mystical or religious. But I do believe that everything is connected to everything else. And ultimately, I think that even an invented use of colloid suspensions in order to suggest the unconscious or consciousness may not be just a metaphor. That is, it may be literally another form of the base concept. That's how far I go. Now, if I may speak of PLUS, I don't know whether to read a page of that or
yeah,
not.
I don't.
I don't think people.
Could
someone get? I think it's on the table there.
I have a copy here.
Oh, do you? Okay.
Everything
I wanted to, because this. I mean, this has to do with realism. Oh, that's a beauty. Yeah, that was the original Knopf. Yeah. Yeah, this is a very good book.
Why don't you tell them what it's about?
It's a very good book. I'm really proud of this, and I had an argument with John Barth because I was teaching down at Hopkins at the time that the book came out. He didn't. He likes my work, but he didn't like this book because he felt it should be more like Calvino, Cosmic Comics. It isn't. You know, this is Presbyterian, or if not Presbyterian, this is severe. This is severe, but it's also beautiful, and students quite recently who have read it and told me have found it to be comic also in a touching sense. It is about a brain, as we learn if we read closely, but it's not really the way the book is written, the brain of an engineer who had a terminal cancer and consented to be part of an experiment in which his brain would be taken from his body and put into a capsule, and put into synchronous orbit around the Earth in order for information to emanate from it one way or another. This is done in fairly considerable detail in the book. And I first wrote it in the first person. What a disaster.
And what is the name of the brain?
The name of the brain is IMP Plus, Interplanetary Monitoring Platform Plus, baby. A little bit more, huh? And so often people, when they've spoken of the book, have said, your brain called Plus. I said, no, IMP Plus. And not because my mother...
And isn't it true that I mean, I've read that you have said that the name derives because in the margins of books, when something was important, you would write IMP.
I forgot that entirely.
Well, I read that.
No, you're right. No, it's there.
So there it is.
And my mother used to call me an imp, and not in a very nice way either. I mean, she was threatened, and understandably so. I want to cut away from all this. There is a garden of nourishment in the capsule, and this is it's done enough so that it's persuasive. There's very little about the engineer's former life. Although as the book develops, there are little glimpses because his memory returns. I'm assuming that if this were ever done to you, it would be pretty traumatic. Your brain, presumably with the possibilities of consciousness, taken from the rest of your body and put into a system that would nourish it and keep it alive. And then other things are happening, like blast-off, and the capsule is out there. And there are people on Earth who are monitoring what's going on and getting information and so forth. So that's partly what this is about. But the people are reduced to two. There's the acrid voice and the... What's the other name? The other...
Isn't it good and acrid?
There's the good voice and the acrid voice. Yeah. Right. The good voice and the acrid voice. And, I mean, there are others. Obviously, it's like Mission Control at Cape Kennedy or something. And so basically what happens is that IMP Plus regains whatever he regains, because I raised the question of whether a brain is still male. It's not a big question in the book. And in the course of this, ultimately, IMP Plus resists what is being imposed upon him or it from ground. And there are consequences of that, which is what the denouement of the book is about. But in the course of this, the means, the medium by which we know and also by which IMP Plus grows is language. Because, and this was the tough thing, but, you know, I got myself into it, and I enjoyed it, and I think I did it pretty well. It's not a first-person book. I mean, I realized after 40 pages, this was really corny, and impossible for me to do. And did that mean that I wanted something cold and distant? No, but I wanted something powerful and I almost said respectable, but I wanted an angle that would enable me to encompass the whole reality that I was trying to convey. And when this was published by Knopf, Bob Gottlieb, who was then the editor at Knopf, said, well, I would have liked it more if we'd had a little bit more about the blind news dealer that he remembers and the woman on the beach in California. Whereas for me, these were exquisite moments because I knew I was only going to do them in tiny, tiny glints. And I think that worked pretty well. What I'm getting to is this. When the book was reviewed and often commented upon by sympathetic and very intelligent people, it was seen as a fantasy. You smile. Well, of course, it's a fantasy, McElroy. What are you trying to sell here? It was seen as a fantasy about language. And I didn't see it that way, basically. I found language to be the natural medium in which would be rendered the experience of this creature, and that language would be the medium in which we would plot and follow his growth. His growth toward what? Well, back to will, back to person, back to action, even. And I think the book is in the end not arty, and I saw it as a book about an experiment more than an experimental American novel. I know I'm pushing things here, but that's the way I saw it. I thought, given the premise, and I was thinking back to a movie I saw when I was 6 or 7 years old about a rich guy who is dying and he wants to have his brain preserved or something, you know, awful science fiction kind of idea. But I plucked that out and thought I'd do something else with it. Given the premise, how do you do this realistically? And that's what I felt that I did. Not the realism that Flaubert was talking about, much less the realism that Dreiser was talking about, or Hemingway, or Updike. All of those, in their own ways, worthy practitioners of observation of the world. But in a way, having invented a world, I nonetheless felt that it was distantly plausible. And that being the case, I wanted to present the fiction as accurately as I could.
Well, one of the things, I feel this for me is very familiar territory because I had a very enjoyable but embarrassing science fiction period growing up. And what was phenomenal to me, what is phenomenal to me about this book and about very few other books that could be said to have had science fiction premises. I'm thinking about some certain stories and the later novels of Ballard and a book by a guy named John Clute, who is a big science fiction writer. And
Ballard I know well.
And they strike me, there's a lot of science fiction is speculative in this way of they're asking what if questions, you know, and the typical what if. I mean, my book, this is a very what if book. Satires tend to be what if books. Speculative science fiction would be what if books. You propose a situation, you propose an experiment, and then you write a book with a number of variations on answers to this question. This book plus is very. It's not speculative. It knows what it wants to say. It's not attempting to answer a question, what if this brain was put in a capsule? It is actually living the experience for you. And it is almost, it's almost the notes once the experiment is finished, the conclusions of the experiment. And what was very striking to me about this book is, you can say when people, you know, the typical rhetoric about books like this is the authority with which it's written, but it's not about authority. It's really, the ability to project yourself into a situation, to project your consciousness into a situation, as opposed to treating characters or treating situations as if they were kind of cardboard, pasteboard devices. And
it's
so,
realistic in that sense. Yeah.
And one of the most interesting things is, you know, while you say it's kind of fantasy of language, that the two voices, there's the good voice and the accurate voice, and it's really also about not only conscience experiencing this, but the variations of response to the manipulation of stimulus, maybe, and it's and so the function that memory plays in the book, and these little that Mr. Gottlieb wanted you to probably, you know, elaborate on.
He would have felt more comfortable with that.
Sure, yeah. They're actually fascinating because they serve these they serve a function of being so real as to seem the most irreal things in the book. The things that we could most relate to,
that's interesting,
seem the most foreign because we're so encapsulated, pardon the pun.
Perfunctory, they're there because the author thinks he ought to give that to the reader.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. This is too much about me. And
it's fine.
Yeah, well, just a word about science, because it may be a characteristic of the big book. I mean, good big American novels, and this is one of the good ones, not all big American novels, that they try to embrace not history, not only history, or American visions, consciousness, but that they try to include the heterogeneous languages, vocabularies, that I think we, in this fucked up country, have maybe more than most other literatures that I know anything about. And it's one reason why this country has been an interesting country to live in and to write in. You know, it's you feel off balance a lot of the time, but you can do it in a pure way and write absolutely pellucid with a limited vocabulary fictions. But you can do it in another way. I think that Joshua does, although there is an overriding voice that returns again and again. In such a way as to suggest that the world that's being portrayed here it is a world that expresses itself in the vocabularies of many different disciplines. I think that's always been, it was always my desire to do that, because I felt, not to show off, but I felt that that was closer to what it was like to live here. It was closer to what it was like to try to think in all this noise. And one way is to join it, and you join it, and the vocabularies come in, and you try to separate them. You try to find a way to use them. Insofar as I'm not a science writer, or certainly not a science fiction writer, but I felt from the beginning, even in A Smuggler's Bible back in 1966, that the idioms of our consciousness were partly technological. Technology is maybe invention, and science is perhaps discovery, but they blur together, as you know. And that was partly why I was interested in science and technology. I mean, it was partly because it was one of our languages and one of our realities. Torsten Veblen said somewhere that technology is neutral. It's the way it's what we do with it that makes it so bad. And you can have that argument for a long time. And people have wondered whether I'm a cold calculating technologist or a freak of some kind because of my interest in this. But no, it's one of the languages that we have, just as a language of Jewish family life is one of the languages that he has. It's not the only one by a long shot. And it may be that a variety of vocabularies being one of the things that ambitious, young American novelists inherit has something to do with the long book. The long book is partly long, and it's an attempt. This is not his first novel, but it might look like a first novel to some people. But it's not a first novel in the bad sense that you try to say everything that's on your mind. You don't leave anything out. An example of the first novel that goes against that entirely is Updike's first novel. It was characteristic of him that he would write a first novel, The Poor House Fair, which is not trying to say everything. You know, it's not Thomas Wolfe. It's Updike. But to try to write a large book that says an awful lot and that it incorporates a lot of history and a lot of languages is what he's tried to do with this. And thinking about what a long book imposes upon the reader, I think not at all about the difficulty of a long book. That doesn't interest me at all. You know, it's either good or it's not good. What I do think about is the difference between, let's say, a novella or a short story and a novel, because I think that classically and now, novels are narratives to be in, to live in, to exist in, not primarily forms to jump into and get to the end of. And while that is one of the pleasures, I could name some interesting novelists for whom that is the main pleasure, that's the main pleasure you get out of it. Mm-hmm. I think there's another pleasure, which is partly rereading, but it's partly expatiating. It's partly becoming the main character, as Proust says in the first page of his novel, that when he would read, Marcel would read, he would think that he was the main character. But it isn't even that. It's a substance that the novel, that a great big novel like this becomes, which invites you to be in it, not necessarily to leave it, to move around in it, to move laterally. And I think that's what you do here. And the problem is to keep your reader with you. When Women and Men came out, Harold Brodkey said to me that he thought I should have had a continuing historical familial narrative, as like War and Peace. That wasn't what I was trying to do at all. I had other metaphors to one hoped keep the narrative together.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say a brief thing. I think this is a point on which we disagree, because I would like to believe that these large narratives are these invitations for a reader to lose themselves. I intended the length of this book to be much more of a, if not a provocation, then an insult. I feel in many ways betrayed by the education that I was given and the education I gave myself, betrayed in a generational way that probably everybody in this room feels, to prize certain things and then to see them become generally usurped by the image, usurped by sound and image, technologically defiled from within the Jewish tradition, seeing being brought up in certain ways of reading things, having a traditional Jewish education, being brought up in other languages and other disciplines, and then kind of being told, once this education is finished, we expect you to do something normative and remunerative. It's these elements of betrayal that lead me to want to then write a book that could be as much a tombstone as something that's read. I would almost like it to be kept in people's houses and they wouldn't have to read it. Just every time they look at it, they'd feel bad about themselves. That would make me, I mean...
Allow me to differ with you, because, okay. I mean, I've only read 500 pages of it, but I'm there's no question at all that I'm just going to go on right to the end. Okay. William Gass says this somewhere. Mm-hmm. In him, it's arty. It's not arty in you. It's perhaps self persuading or even self-destructive, the way you put it. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that I'm going to have that feeling by the time I get to the end of the book.
Yeah.
Gass said he'd like to write a book that was like a piece of ruined architecture, and it would just go on and on and on and on and on.
Sure.
But socially, that's not acceptable, because there are other books that you got to read as well.
I feel like
you can have your motive.
Sure.
Like that.
I mean, I can.
It doesn't necessarily
translate
into the book that's absorbing.
Sure. I mean, one of the purposes of having a motive that pessimistic is to insure oneself against the disappointment at its reception. But also, part of having a motive like that is to understand the nature of what I want to write. I mean, the ideal book, and that's not the ideal book, but the ideal book that I could possibly write would be one that would, you know, in that very trite sense, change someone's life. And something that does that needs to, in some way, be provocative and be assaulting on many different levels. And one of the things that I wanted to do...
You have to think twice, though, about whether you want to be provocative and assaulting or insulting
sure.
through length.
You're right, but one of the things that I wanted to produce with this book specifically was to address this the tradition of Jewish literature, the brief efflorescence of Jewish literature in America over the last 60, 70 years, and to sort of talk about its ethical weaknesses, its misogyny, its...
That certainly comes through quite early in the book.
Yeah, it's...
But it's juxtaposed with some wonderful set pieces about the... They're familiar. The material's familiar, but nonetheless it's powerful stuff about the degeneration of the culture that is around us. It's revolting. It's disgusting. It's horrifying. And you the only way to do it is the way you're doing it, which is to do it and do it. Just go keep doing it with volume. And I assume that there's going to be an element of that in the rest of the book.
When I was writing a portion of it, I spent a lot of time in certain public libraries in different cities, and one of the things you realize when you spend a lot of time in public libraries in different cities is that they're inhabited by the same people in every city, which is to say the homeless, and that there are essentially two types of homeless people that patronize most libraries. There's the type that goes there and use the library bathrooms to shower and to put themselves together and to try to go out and find a job and to look like, you know, quote unquote respectable people. And then there's, you know, a lot of homeless who are there to read, and they allow themselves to, they don't avail themselves of the bathrooms, and they allow themselves to kind of allow their squalor as if it is as if impressing upon everyone else that the homeless are their problem, that this is what your society has done to me. And in a sense, I wanted to make a book that had some of that aspect, that, mm-hmm. that said, you know, the flaws of logic in this book, the anger in this book, the impatience in this book are your fault, meaning the reader's fault, and you have done this to me, so for $22.95, deal with it. Mm-hmm. And I definitely felt that there needed to be a literature that showed the reader to himself, to herself. And
maybe I'll feel that and discover it before I get to the end. At the moment, I'm working at it only in the sense that it's dense prose and always rewarding, but I'm in it. And it reminds me, among many other things, of the importance of the sentence. Occasionally you will get into a sentence the end of which never seems to come, but one doesn't mind. The sentence is a narrative in itself. Of course, brief sentences can be narratives. Jesus wept, not a very good example, but there's a two-word sentence. It's a narrative in itself. But many sentences in this book are narratives, and I think that I operate that way too. But there's an intoxicating, alluring attraction in a lot of the prose. So as far as I've gone, I haven't been repelled or...
You have a strong stomach.
...or insulted. I have. Let me just read this. This is a little longer than what he read, but he's been talking about me too much. It's a set piece, and it makes me think of the sentence as narrative. But it may be also that the big book is a model of something which is always true of books that absorb us. Our minds go in a lot of different places. And if we think of the art of writing as an art or craft of controlling the reactions of the reader, which to some extent it is, that can only be partly true, because you really cannot know what the reader brings to the book. And so part of what happens in the experience of reading, as Proust says so well, is the tangents and the personal expatiations that happen parenthetically in the middle of a sentence that he can't have any foresight of, except that he knows they're he knows the reader, and he knows that they're happening, but they're happening with as many experiences of this as there are people who will read this book, and I think many will read it. Anyway, there's a moment in the middle of the second paragraph where I take off. I mean, just thinking of it, and so it's a question. It's only a gratuitous philosophical question of whether I'm still in his narrative. I like to think that I am in his narrative, and I have somehow come to inhabit it in another way because I'm having several thoughts that occur to me because of what he's written, and he couldn't know it. And like a visiting relative, an unwelcome guest, that Xmas just refused to leave. It never packed up its bags. He's got packed up together, that's why I read it that way. It never packed up its bags, bulging with snow to melt in the flea of the sun. Never put on its cap and went out unafraid to greet the cold that was its own, its true home. It was endless, unbearable. What? It just sat around the house. What are we talking about? We're still talking about Xmas. It just sat around the house, turned to a puddle to profane the floor. Having forgotten its own toothbrush and towel it had to borrow, it clawed up the couch, stuck its snout into everything, became fattened. I'm almost hearing Eliot's Evening in the Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock here. Became fattened on what was fed it, which was all we had, then the furniture, and lastly ourselves. Christmas eating up the furniture and eating up the people in the house, and soon began to warm, to reek with putrefaction. Let me just go on a little bit more, because it's good. This is not a writer who's trying to send us away. It was Xmas time forever, for seasons at a time. At first, I mean, it's lovely, the metaphorical enlargement there. His use of the long sentence is not only as narrative, but also as breathing. It's also expansion and contraction, expansion and contraction. At first, deep into a month once known as January, a duplicitous, two-faced month named after that ancient Roman deity, Janus, king of Latium, the god of beginnings. And I stop at this point, and I've always been interested in beginnings. I mean, how can you not be when you're told that everything else is part of process and has causes and so forth, but God is, you know? Don't ask where God came from. God is. So beginnings have always been interesting to me, very, very much.
It's interesting that the god of beginnings is actually a later Roman god.
Yes, of course.
They only invented him very late.
Right.
I always thought that was great.
Oh. And narrators are interested in beginnings also because of backstory. Excuse me, I know this isn't a class in construction, but you got to worry about backstory, whether you're writing a crappy old film or writing a wonderful novel. Where does the past come in? Probably it shouldn't come in right away, because chronology is the least interesting of forms, it seems to me. You got to give the reader chronology, but not necessarily in order. So, Latium, the god of beginnings, the god of endings, of gates like those two capital D developments, and of doors like those set with knockers and bells, buzzers and intercoms, and etched glass to a house since fallen. The patron, you see how the sentence is not only a narrative, and it begins with a metaphor. The visitor, Christmas is like a visitor, and then he takes off on that, and that takes you somewhere else, and it is not someone rambling, much less senile. I might be, I'm old enough to be senile. I'm hoping I'm not going to be, but he's not rambling. He's not rambling.
Yeah.
He's partly looping. But there are other geometrical images for what he's doing. He's tangentially moving, but he's staying close, physically close almost, to the body that he was tangent to. And there is always an interior logic. There's the outer sentence and the inner sentence. There's this logic that keeps us close to where this whole passage began. I don't know how exactly he does it, and I almost don't want to know, but he does it. A god whom no one thinks to worship anymore, a forsaken spurned God. Omnipotent and yet abandoned, omniscient and yet ignored. The harshness, I believe here, the causticness of the writer's voice comes in. The betrayed. Nothing better. I mean, narratives, short stories, all kinds of stories are about betrayal. They're always about betrayal. You can't do it without betrayal. The writing teachers say, conflict, you need conflict. It's true, but, you know, what kind and how do you do it? But betrayal is a better word, I think, betrayal. And there's an element of caustic, abrasive betrayal, which comes into the prose, which nonetheless has this overriding voice, which is lyrical, almost sweet, although I wouldn't burden him with that charge. Fluid. Without him, capital H, it's the way my Christian cousin Mildred, now no longer with us, who was a Bible Belt Christian, used and never married, would speak of Jesus. Him. 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 And I say it with love and pity. But it was...
There's an element of betrayal there,
it
too.
It was her relation. Yeah, well, I think she felt she never was betrayed.
Okay.
And she had a... She had an unusual beneficent, an unusually beneficent death. Well, I'm happy for her. That wasn't supposed to get a laugh. That wasn't supposed to get a laugh. But it did. You can't spurn your laughs. And you can't spurn the pleasures that your prose gives people. Although I know you want to. You're young. Imagine my luck to be reading with someone who's 50 years younger. Really? Just a little bit more. Without him, no one knows which way to face. See, that's resonant. That's amplifyingly resonant. It's Janus, both sides and all. But it's suddenly become a sweeping philosophical summing up of how any thinking person can exist, the need of questioning which way to face, whether to the past or the future. Well, the answer is both, you know. He knows that. Or else just to stand forever upon the threshold, searching this way and that. You mentioned in something you read of mine, parable, and when I came here, because literature begets literature, and literature comes from literature, I try to explain that to students on the rare occasions when I teach. It isn't just raw experience, your raw experience. You know, more often than not, it's what you just read that's inspired the work. And that doesn't mean that you're literary and therefore unreal. It just means that what you read means a lot to you, and it is part of your reality, and it's an inspiration. And so when he comes to the threshold here, I've got a friend in Vermont, a writer, who made up the name of her little lane in Vermont where she lives. It's called Threshold Way. Upon the threshold, searching this way and that. I thought of that parable at the end of the trial of Kafka. Do you remember?
Mm-hmm.
And there's the door. And the guy's waiting forever and ever and ever.
Before the law.
That's right, before the law. And then the word comes out to him. This door was meant only for you. Mm-hmm. We're now going to shut it. And waiting for your whole life. And I have no idea whether you had that in your mind. Probably not. But it's there on the page and it comes into my mind. So there's definitely something chaotic about the process of writing to a reader who then reads and experiences in some full way the prose. There's definitely something chaotic.
Well, I will then make a very brief to this small group. The secret that, I don't know, I've talked to about 10 people who finished the book and 5 of them figured this out. But toward the end, there's a tour of Europe and a group visits the grave of a writer.
and says that it's the grave of a very famous writer, you should come in and see it. And they can't make it into the grave because one day it's closed, and the next day they're doing some maintenance. And then the day after that, they had too many people coming out in the gate and filled up the gateway, and they couldn't get through. And, you know, the entire joke is it's these guys wanted to visit Kafka's grave and were never able to visit it. And it's kind of like my parable within the parable. I mean, Kafka has the parable that, you know, something happens, and then it's foreseen to have happened, you know, and then it's written into the law. And this was sort of a... this was trying to be the apotheosis of these of this 20th century drive to kind of parabolize everything, you know, parable coming from the parabola that goes in an arc and then comes back down to its point of departure. Yeah. And it seems to me that
how interesting.
That this motion is a very 20th century motion. It's a motion of thinking. It's a motion of, especially in a culture of reference, we are constantly referencing things. It's a motion of speaking. And on one hand, it's a wonderful inheritance because you're taught to critically think about something and draw connections and to have one point, to have another point, and to synthesize them and to bring conversations full circle, like I'm trying to do now. But on the other hand, it's a wearying baggage because it tells you that you're always stuck within the loop of your own consciousness. You're always stuck within the loop of your own idea. And so part of my nesting of this
Kafka story... This is why spirals interest us so much.
Yeah.
How they have an element of hope.
Sure, an element of hope, but it's just one more false... It's a red herring, you know? But what I feel by putting this Kafka thing was to kind
He's
of,
a good counterpose to my optimism.
Well, you are eternally young, and I feel like I'm 50 years older. But I think that...
I won't accept that.
Okay. But this Kafka parable within the Kafka parable, the point of it was trying to question this inheritance of departure and return. This something that we see in the West in music, in sonata form with recapitulations, at the, you know, where something returns to its home key in music. We see it in the way that the square and the rectangle have evolved in as the frame of paintings, at least. And I just, it was always very interesting to me.
You see, he's not afraid of abstraction. He understands how it's seminal and necessary, unavoidable. It's always there to be taken from the substance, and it always goes back. It's part of our thinking, and it doesn't mean that you're cold or distant from your material, the ability to step away from it and see patterns. Well, I think that's one thing that attracted me about this book.
I mean, one of the in brief conclusion to this Christmas section, one of the things in the book that I talk about a lot is the calendar, because the calendar is that ultimate loop, and you know, it's that ultimate recurrence. It's you know, especially the religious calendar, which seeks to kind of modify the social behavior of the community by having, you know, the same festivals every year. And obviously these are, you know, autosynthesis produced, where you have the spring being a rebirth festival and winter having all of these kind of mournful festivals. And one of the interesting things, one of the things that I tried to bring out in the book is a sort of calendrical rebellion. You know, how does one kind of... work against this recurrence, work against this, you know, sacred looping, and redeem oneself, and it's something that I've never been able to do in my life. You know, I mean.
Well, we're locked into the seasons for one thing.
Sure.
Maybe we should live in Florida.
Maybe we should, but you know, they still do Rosh Hashanah every year in Florida, you know, and probably there more than ever. But anyway, one of the goals of this book, in terms of its length, was also to kind of, I mean, it's impossible, but an attempt to obliterate the cycle, to keep on going, to not return, to extend the year, to extend, because the calendar dissolves in the book around page 600-something, to go into that raw material of time, you know, what a lot of thinkers at the time of the great catastrophe that this book kind of centers around, meaning the Holocaust, saw as a period of messianic time, without calendar, without meaning, almost without celestial guidance, and so that was something I definitely, these were concerns I definitely had when it comes to parables. Anyway, did I bring it all?
No, I'm just thinking that silence has its speech also.
We could sit here in silence until we obliterate time.
We could.
You're not speaking of yourself. No.
Or we could take maybe
we could take some
five,
questions.
5 minutes for concluding remarks, and then if anyone has questions.
Oh, we don't have to end now, do we?
I'm happy to sit.
Oh, I know. You've got. Oh, no. It's 8 o'clock. You've got Bartleby.
We do have. So we only have a couple more hours.
I think it would be.
I'd like to hear from some of these people. I have a lot. The guy we were talking with last night, this Melville scholar, said he wasn't very good at quoting. I don't believe that. I mean, I'm sure he has a lot of quotes, but we were talking about silence, and I had a quote at that moment, but I didn't slip it in because we went somewhere else. But I'm thinking of silence again, and thinking of the glamour of the space program in the very early 70s, very early. And I went down to cover a few launches for the Times and for another magazine, and I was into it. And I still know a lot about it, but the glamour has changed a little bit. But even then, some of the shimmer of mystery and abstractness, which came from a few utterances that I remember, stay with me. And Eugene Cernan, who was the skipper of Apollo 17, which was the first night launch, and I was down there. I remember chatting with Vonnegut while we were waiting for it to go off, and it was delayed. And the delay was part of what I wrote about also, and how the delay somehow fitted into a new sense of the style of the space program, which was so perfect. And the delay somehow added something to it. Cernan later wrote in a book, "The absence of sound in space is more than just silence." Hokey, right? The absence of sound in space is more than just silence. I don't think he was speaking as a Christian or something there. Maybe he was. But I'm thinking of the acalendrical or the beyond calendrical time that you're talking about, and that's interesting. It's interesting.
I mean, I maybe this is a concluding thought, but it's one of the things that I've from being very young, from a very young age, the apparatus wasn't there to write, the education certainly wasn't there, the amount of reading wasn't there, but the one thing that has remained from my earliest memories was the desire to always extend something and to find the edge of something, to the edge of something that was acceptable to a parent or a teacher, to find the even the endings of stories, which I used to read the last page first and then imagine what came before it. Is to always to find the end of something and to use that as a point of departure. And one of the I remember very probably the thought of a book that was only made of last sentences, you know, or and then for a while I was very interested in epitaphs and funeral inscriptions and the idea of last sentences and these kind of thanatopsical thoughts. And one of the impulses that remained to inform this book certainly was this obsession with lastness, dehiscent obsession with lastness, while at the same time using that for a renewal or a rebirth. And
in other words, it may be, it's a good therapeutic metaphor, I'm sure, that you're not going to get reborn until you reach and have to suffer lastness with its risk of really being last.
And also feeling that you know, that in every generation one can elect to embrace this feeling of lastness and what it means. So when you talk about silence, I think that it's been an indulgence of mine, but also a privilege to feel that I write on the brink of a new silence, and that what I write has little chance of being heard. What I write has little chance of meaning something in the capital M meaning, but that the freedom of that silence, which has been technologically, et cetera, the freedom of that silence is very interesting to me as a subject, and so. In a sense, you know,
it becomes another subject.
Yeah, and so in a sense, if I was to write a sequel to Plus, it would be a book in a capsule,
okay,
orbiting Earth.
Great. So, if I had the money, I'd get into that capsule and go along with it.
That's true.
Yeah, thanks.